We're continuing into our teaching time now, and if there's one thing I appreciate about my new setup is that I've got a spot for my coffee. So I hope you brought your own. You'll notice we're not doing our coffee time just because, well, it should be obvious. We're not serving coffee right now. We're not serving food. That hopefully will come. But this is our last Sunday in the series that we've been working through called Reset. This could easily go for months at a time, but this was the conclusion that I planned, and so we're going to continue. We're going to kind of lay on the plane here. And for those who haven't been with us, we've been going through this rhythm of asking the question, what should life look like moving forward? We've been in this strange season of pause, and we are experiencing a strange moment for many of us because we are given this opportunity in the middle of this negativity, if you will, to choose what will come next. Because nothing is assumed anymore. Nothing is a foregone conclusion. I was talking to my father not that long ago. My father's part of a big multinational corporation, and they're talking about what does business as usual look like now? Because they've been able to continue relatively effectively by distance working. And what does the work week look like now? What are they going to use to measure productivity, to measure employee effectiveness? And will they continue to go about business as usual, or will they seek to develop new metrics to measure their success and to measure their growth? And in this time, we're starting to notice, I've started to notice that there is something different that God is offering to us. And even though this has been challenging and overwhelming and frustrating, I also have noticed that it has given me a reprieve from normal. Because the more that I have found myself farther and farther away from normal, the more I've started noticing, not that I don't miss it, but realizing that I shouldn't. Realizing that normal isn't worth pining for. Noticing that normal isn't really worth missing. Because while there are many things that were good and will continue to be good, a lot in our lives were not worth pining for because normal wasn't working. And the more I've been thinking about this, the more I feel like this series is so well-timed to give us a fresh perspective on life, a fresh perspective on how should we continue to walk forward. Because we are out of alignment in our world. And even in our church, there are so many of us that felt like they had no control over how they lived their lives. They felt like they had no say in their schedule. And I don't think that's how God designed us to be. I don't think that's how we should be. Healthy people are not people who allow the world to dictate their lives to them, but the most healthy people take control of their lives and say, this will be how I choose to live. And I think this season, God gives us an opportunity to define that new normal, to hit the reset button, and to embrace a life that looks markedly different than what normal used to be, to embrace and redefine a new normal that embodies a life that looks differently than the culture around us, that adopts a life that honors God and restores our equilibrium back to our lives, so that we can perhaps for the first time in years, if not ever, we can experience a peace that has long been missing from our lives. And this reset is going to require some tough questions that we have to ask. It's going to require us to really critically engage. And if you haven't been challenged through this, then I need you to teach me, because this has been one of those series where I've been teaching myself first, because it has been challenging me to reprioritize some things, to be asking myself some hard questions. And as we conclude this series, I want to once again invite you to allow God to prompt you, to allow him to challenge your preconceptions. And as he reveals himself to you, to allow yourself to be transformed by God. And there are so many directions that we could go to close out this series. And like I said, we could go on for several more weeks, but the more I've thought about this, the more it feels like the most natural ending to challenge us to embrace a life of service that challenges our selfishness. I think perhaps one thing in the world around us that pretty much everyone can agree on is that we are inherently selfish. This is a humanity reality. Parents, nobody ever had to teach your kids how to be selfish. Last I worked with kids, there was no requirement for you to teach your boys how to be selfish. That is something that we just somehow learn from a very young age, how to say, this is mine, and also I want that one over there. It was never part of any curriculum. Along the way, it just naturally develops within us. And it is the understanding that we have in the world around us. Some of us even, we are smart about it. See, selfishness doesn't manifest itself in the same way in all people. Some of us, we develop a faux humility to try to leverage that faux humility into honoring from other people. It's the world around us is inherently teaching us how to get what we want in new and exciting ways. We expect it. We want it. And I wonder if it's something that we assume is the reality and is the way, not that it should be, but the way that it is. And so we resign ourselves to living in a selfish world and seeking out that which the world values, because if the world values it, we must value it ourselves. And selfish desires, they sneak their way into every element of our lives. We always yearn for that one thing that we feel like is missing within us. We're searching until we find it, which then, of course, we find that the thing that we longed for doesn't bring us the fulfillment that we quite expected. And this creates situations in our lives that look quite ugly. Spouses that feel undervalued sometimes will start looking for somebody that will make them feel more appreciated. Employees that long for success at all costs become willing to sabotage or undermine others in the pursuit of climbing the ladder. Friends will snipe and backbite and even lie and gossip about their friends so that they can position themselves in a better place within their social circles. Politicians, you know, will say anything and everything so that they can gain an advantage in an upcoming election, or at least so they can have a higher percentage of people approving of their work. Consumer mentality in the culture, it drives us to find our value in things, in people that make us feel good. It empowers our selfish behavior. We are often rewarded in the world around us for not just being selfish, but by being successful at being selfish. And this isn't something that's new. This isn't something that is a sudden modern development. It is something that happened from the very beginning and appears to have been hard-coded in our world ever since. Egocentrism is nothing new, but it persistently manifests itself in our homes and in our schools and our workplaces and even in our churches. And the danger is that our selfish desires have the dual threat of dividing us from one another and dividing us from God. Last week, we discussed God's design for Christian community. And we looked at the way that God created humanity to be and who God created humanity to be. And we noted that our struggle with each other found its origins in the garden at the very beginning of the book of Genesis. And in Genesis chapter 3, we have the story of humanity's first rebellion against God. And we looked at the outcomes of their first rebellion. But we didn't spend much time considering the why of the rebellion. We simply looked at the results of it. But when you look at the underlying story, at what caused humanity to rebel, you'll see the same struggle that we often have today. Genesis 3 tells that story so well, and the author of the book of Genesis tells us that a serpent tempted the first woman, later named Eve, to partake in a forbidden fruit with a very poignant argument. He first says, "Did the Lord God tell you that if you ate any tree in the garden, you will die?" And the woman responds, "Well, no, he just said this one tree, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. If we eat this tree or the tree fruit from this tree, then we will die." And the serpent says, "Well, no, hold up. You won't die," the serpent replied to the woman. "God knows that your eyes will be open as soon as you eat it, and you will become like God, knowing both good and evil." Boy, that rain is something, man. The flood's not happening for a few more chapters, so I don't know. We're not... No, that's all right. We'll get back to that. That actually will come, that will connect, though, if you want to read ahead. But the very thing that convinces the first humans to consume of that fruit is their selfish desire for personal advancement. They wanted to be like God. It wasn't enough that they had an intimate relationship with the creator of the universe. It wasn't enough to enjoy the creation that God had given to them. It wasn't even enough that God had given them the garden of perfection with next to no restrictions. What mattered in that moment, at that time, was there was something holding them back from being like God. And as the serpent said, if they consumed that fruit, that's what would make them like God. And it would appear that that did the trick, that was enough. In this moment, these first humans saw equality with God, something to grasp. And we don't know what changed with this interaction with the serpent. We don't know whether or not they'd ever looked upon that the fruit of that tree before. We don't know if they'd ever considered it. Maybe they just never thought that they could aspire to more. Maybe they just assumed that what they had was all they had and all they could ever want. Maybe they just had never thought that it could be more. But now, in fact, Genesis 3, verse 6 says that the woman was convinced and she looked and saw that the tree was beautiful and that the fruit looked delicious. Suddenly, all she could see was the fruit of the tree, and she wanted the wisdom that it would give her. This lens that she was given was all that she could see through now. She saw not just that the fruit was delicious, but everything that it stood for and everything that it promised to her. Have you ever had something like that where you find out information about something and it transforms the way you see everything? It could be looking back on a situation and you learn a critical piece of information and suddenly it paints a different picture. I've had that before where I thought something happened and I looked at it as inherently negative, but finding out in hindsight at what I was protected from changes the way that I saw that. But by the same token, I've also had situations where I have allowed my viewpoint to cloud relationships, or where I've allowed my insecurities to assume the worst of people, and then I come to treat people as I assume they think of me, and so the lens through which I see has clouded my judgment and has ruined relationships. And so these first humans, they see equality with God as something to be grasped. And now that all they can see is this promise of being like God, it says that the woman reached out and took the fruit and ate of it. And Genesis 3:7 tells us the serpent wasn't lying, which is an interesting thing to realize, because their eyes were open. And in that moment, they truly achieved what until then only God had been able to experience. But in seeking after the position and the perspective and the power of God, their selfish desires became their undoing. They were convinced that equality with God was something to be grasped, something to be reached for, something to be forcibly taken. And in doing that, in grasping that fruit and consuming it in their selfishness, they lost everything that they already possessed. They lost their relationship with God. They lost the promise of life eternal. And even their relationship with each other was tarnished in a way that they would never be able to fully recover from. And when I look at the world around us, when I look in my own life, I realize that in a way we've been replicating the fall ever since. In a way, we have been consuming the fruit and buying its lies that we should be more, that we should increase. We chase after our selfish desires. Our pride drives us to take God's place, to usurp his authority, and to place ourselves as our ultimate authority. Our pride ever drives us to elevate our importance and to see others as inherently and instinctually worth less, at least compared to us. Humanity has been battling, but not really that hard. We've more been embracing our selfish and prideful tendencies for millennia. And the tragedy of the story of God's people throughout history has been the prolonged battle of Eden. Even as God graciously invites his people into a relationship with him, even as he generously forgives them and meets them where they are at. More and more often, we see the story of God's people as a story of a people who are not satisfied with what God is offering to them. It's a story of people that always demand more, demand better, and demand quicker. And the challenge of the story of Adam and Eve is not just that it's a story that happened. We often talk about what would it be like if Adam and Eve had never eaten the fruit, if the fall had never happened. But the more I know about humanity, the more that I wonder whether or not we were destined to do that. That somebody along the way would see the promise of the fruit and consume it out of rebellion. Because I see that continually happening. It's not just a story that happened, it's a story that happens, often on a daily basis. We buy the lie that the serpent, so to speak, not a literal serpent, but we buy the lie that we deserve more, that we deserve better. We convince ourselves that perhaps God doesn't have our own best interest at heart. We hear the lie that perhaps we could do it better, that we could be more effective, and if we just had control, then we would be better off. We hear the accuser whisper to our ears, putting doubt about the goodness of God in our mind. And we, like Adam and Eve before us, want to be like God. And so we eat the fruit. We eat the fruit every time. But Jesus marks the start of something new. Jesus offers us something different, because if there's one thing that we can know from the story of God's people before Jesus, was it's a story of cyclical failure, of a cycle of trying and failing at a relationship with God, at trying to measure up to what God would have for them. But in Jesus, we see not only the portrait of what humanity should live like, and as Paul refers to Jesus, as death comes through Adam, life comes through Jesus. Jesus is often called the new Adam because he succeeds at what Adam and Eve failed to do. So Jesus models a new way of living and offers us hope because he gives us the chance for life, not on our own strength, but on his. But don't think that just because Jesus modeled something new means that his followers understood. In fact, in Matthew chapter 20, we see his followers locked in an age-old desire to elevate themselves. Even as Jesus is telling them, and this is what's so, it's so unbelievable to a degree, because Jesus in Matthew 20 is telling his followers, listen, we're going to Jerusalem. And when we get to Jerusalem, the Son of Man will be betrayed and will be unjustly executed. But he gives the promise that on the third day he will rise again. And even in the middle of that, we see that somebody gets their mom to ask a question. In verse 21, or 20 and 21, we see that the mother of James and John come and kneel before Jesus to respectfully ask for a favor. In verse 21, Matthew writes, "What is your request?" he asks. And she replies, "In your kingdom, please let my two sons sit in a place of honor next to you, one on your right hand and the other on your left." Jesus answered them by saying, "You don't know what you're asking. Are you able to drink from the bitter cup of suffering I am about to drink?" "Oh, yes," they replied.
we are able.
That last line always gets me. How we often tend to overthink or think too much of our ability to be like Jesus or to take on the responsibilities that Jesus is going to do. Looking at them, I don't know if it's because they weren't listening to what Jesus was just saying, but he is clearly talking about the bitter cup of suffering that he literally said, I'm going to go down there and I'm going to be crucified. I'm going to be executed. Can you do this? And maybe they just assumed it was rhetorical. I don't actually know. But what is interesting is how this reminds of the humanity's draw toward power, even in the midst of Jesus demonstrating a new way to live. Even Jesus saying, I, as God, am going to lay myself down in Jerusalem, his own followers are still drawn in by the promise of power and position and prestige. And if you look around at the world around us, it's not hard to see the impacts of the draw and the desire for power in the world around us. It is a continued place for so many. If you only look at politics, you know that there is this drive to see people attach themselves to an up-and-coming politician who may be able to deliver on the hope and the promise of power. And that's what John and James were doing. Let's be real. The mom is an ancillary character. She's just the one that they're maybe hoping will be able to put them over at the top. This is a request coming directly from James and John. They might have been sitting there like, oh, mom, don't ask such an embarrassing question of me. But come on, this is real here. They had been hoping that if they got in on the ground floor, that they would have that position of power once Jesus reveals himself to be the conquering king that they hoped that he would be. And we actually see in verse 24 that when the other 10 disciples heard what James and John had asked, they were indignant. Now, we could assume that they were indignant for two reasons. One of two reasons. The first is that they were so pious and holy and countercultural that they had never once considered positions of power and authority in the kingdom of God. Or we can assume the actual likely reality that James and John were just the first to ask. We're just ahead of the game. They beat them to the punch. The reality of it all was that in these disciples' hearts, they still had that same draw that Adam and Eve had toward power and position and prestige. They wanted to elevate themselves, even if that meant dividing the people around them. And Jesus says, just like the rulers of the world around them, you long for a piece of the pie, but though the world demanded slavish allegiance to personal advancement, he tells them kingdom advancement is going to look entirely different. In verse 25, he says, you know that the rulers in this world lord it over their people. Officials flaunt their authority over those under them. But with you, it will be different. Whoever wants to be a leader among you must be your servant. Whoever wants to be first among you must become your slave. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. In Luke 22:25, Jesus puts it this way. He says, the kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who exercise authority over them call themselves benefactors. And when people think about kings and people in authority, they tend to go to those with the most power. For Jesus' followers, it was probably the rulers of Rome, Caesar, Augustus, perhaps, who had brutally wrestled power away from those who wanted it and won his position of power at great cost. And like Alexander the Great or Hannibal or the pharaohs of Egypt before him, Caesar sought power to lord it over them, to be a supreme ruler. And interestingly enough, each of these people had a cult-like surrounding them. There was a level of worship that happened over rulers. In fact, Caesar specifically was treated as divine. And it was shockingly common. Actually, one of the phrases that we use without even thinking about them was originally used to subvert a Roman declaration. When we say Jesus is Lord, it's frankly practically meaningless for a lot of us. But when people would say Caesar is Lord, they would say Caesar is over all and above all. He is divine. He is the son of the gods. And so the subversive statement Jesus is Lord rang loud and clear in Roman culture. And Jesus counters that despite the way that the world works, his disciples, his followers, those who come after him must not look like Caesar, but must look like Jesus. And I think one of the challenges that we have in the church is that we assume that Jesus' commitment to serving was a temporary interruption, one that Jesus only embraced for a time. That his instructions illuminated a temporary light. But the more I've thought about this, the more that I've read about the description of who Jesus is, I don't believe that Jesus' example was a temporary facade. One that he would someday shed his cloak of service and of servant leadership and suddenly demand something different. If Jesus is the image of the invisible God, and every description of Jesus is one who serves, then perhaps Jesus is inviting us to bear the image of God by demonstrating his unique nature of service. Maybe while humanity has been locked in this age-old struggle of trying to wrestle prominence away from God, of seeking equality with God, or worse, dominance over God, perhaps Jesus demonstrates and challenges us to rethink what it means to have equality with God or even to be like God. And I think the best place to look and to see this as an illustration is in Philippians chapter 2. Philippians chapter 2 challenges our notion of who God is. And it starts in verse 3. This is Paul writing. It says, "Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility consider others better than yourself. Each of you should look not only to your own interest, but also to the interest of others." Your attitude should be the same as that of Christ Jesus, who being in the very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on the cross. Therefore, God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. If our mindset is to reflect Jesus, Our mindset in our relationships to one another and our mindset in relationship to God, what does that mean? It says, being in very nature God, Jesus did not consider equality with God to be grounds for grasping. It is practically the polar opposite of the first human so many years before that. And I want to zero in here on a word, specifically the word being. When it says that being in very nature God did not consider equality with God grounds for grasping. In the original Greek, this is, I'm not a Greek scholar, but I've been doing some studying this week. In the original Greek, this is called a circumstantial participle, meaning that how you translate what comes after it depends on, or how you interpret the word depends on what comes after it. The surrounding words change the context. So let me give you an example. I am a fan of all things Toronto for sports. It's just about half of the Canadian people are just a fan of what we consider the Mecca of Canada. So if I were to say being a Toronto Raptors fan, I believe that my team will win the championship. That is something that I might say because my team just won the championship. Now, our MVP also skedaddled down to LA, so that might be a pipe dream to begin with. In fact, I feel like basketball at all is a pipe dream right now. But the context of having a championship team leads to the fact that you can have faith in that team. So it's not in spite of the fact that I'm a Toronto Raptors fan, it's because I am a Toronto Raptors fan. The opposite would be, I have a good friend who is a New York Knicks fan. Now, if Nate were to say, being a New York Knicks fan, I believe my team will win the championship, that changes the context entirely, does it not? Because the New York Knicks are famously bad, if I understand it correctly. If I understand it correctly, they're not the greatest team. And so when you say being a New York Knicks fan, I believe my team will win the championship, implies, despite being a Knicks fan, I believe my team will win the championship. And when we read this passage, the way that I am a tail, don't I? Let me put my tail away. When we read this passage in the book of Philippians, what we tend to read is the New York Knicks rather than the Toronto Raptors. What we read is, despite being God, he did not consider equality with God something to be grasped. We treat this as a despite. And it makes perfect sense because it is not in the nature of somebody in power to be a servant. And so God, being in a position of power, would have to lower himself in order to be a servant. In fact, some of our translations literally say, in spite of, or despite being God. In fact, I believe the New Living Translation employs this very way of translating the phrase. But the more I've been studying this week and I've been consulting commentaries, I'm seeing something else suggested here. What if Jesus didn't take on the nature of a servant in spite of being God, but because he was God? What if Jesus didn't merely adopt the form of a servant as if he was putting on a mask and pretending to be something he was not, but instead was revealing something about the nature of God? What if this wasn't a matter of pretending? Like, there are countless stories, if you read about ancient gods in Rome or in Greece, there are countless stories of these gods coming under the cloud of darkness, under the cover of darkness in disguise to perform clandestine operations among humanity. And they do it for a short time, but always reveal themselves after a time to be different than they were pretending to be. But what if this wasn't an act for Jesus? What if this wasn't just a way to pretend to be something different, but actually revealed something more? When Jesus takes on the form of a servant, in the original Greek, they use the same word as being in the form of God. So if he is in the form of God, in the form of a servant, perhaps we have been assuming all of this time the wrong things about God. Because again, Colossians chapter 1 says Jesus is the very image of the invisible God. And so if this is who Jesus is, and Jesus is the full and complete revelation of God, then perhaps God is more servant-driven than we give him credit for. What if Jesus revealed something about the sovereignty of God when he became a servant? What if God's power was somehow revealed in the way that we see as weakness, but was really power? What if being a servant wasn't as weak as we assumed? When Jesus invites his followers to become like him, as opposed to the rulers of the world, he invites them to become like God. The very thing that caused this mess to begin with was the desire of the first humans to be like God. But the thing of it was that they missed through this whole thing. They assumed that they had to elevate themselves to be like God, to take on the nature of God. But what we find in here, what Jesus demonstrates, is that to become like God, you didn't elevate yourself, but you pour yourself out. To become like God is to become like Jesus. And the truest revelation of God, Jesus himself, best revealed the character of God, not by exalting himself, but by humbling himself. Not by puffing himself up, but by pouring himself out. And the life that Jesus invites us to flies in the face of human nature and the culture around us. As Jesus said, the rulers of the world lowered it over their peoples and officials flaunt their authority over them. But Jesus demonstrates what Henri Nouwen calls downward mobility. A willingness to not just see yourself as less, but to lower yourself, to pour yourself out for the benefit and the sake of others. It's choosing the less prestigious seat, allowing yourself to be seen as less, because as John said of Jesus, the night that he washed his disciples' feet, Jesus knew fully who he was. And it was because he knew fully who he was that he took on the role of servant. Downward mobility with Jesus goes radically against my inclinations, against the advice of the world, and against the culture of which I am a part. But Jesus showed that we are most like God when we take on the form of a servant. I tell you what, folks, the world has enough of people looking out for their own benefit. There are more than enough people looking out for what we call number one. We have more than our fair share of people seeking to elevate themselves to the position of God. The tragedy of Eden plays itself out every day in the lives of countless people as they seek to elevate themselves. But Jesus invites us to break the cycle, to buck the trend, to embrace something new and different. The world doesn't know what to do with a Christ-like servant. The world doesn't know what to do with Jesus. And the power of the gospel is that it invites us to live in a way that the world will call foolish. In fact, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 1 that the cross was foolishness to the Gentiles, to the world at large. And it makes sense. A God who lowers himself to the point of a humiliating death was the most foreign thing in the world to them. Rulers didn't do that. Gods didn't do that. Those who aimed to change the world executed their power. But Jesus took the form of a servant. And he changed everything. He brought salvation to the world. And he offered us a fresh start and a new life. He gave us the opportunity and the ability to be born again by the Spirit by showing that power, the way the world understands it, is upside down in the kingdom of heaven. And he invites us to embrace that thinking in ourselves. He invites us to serve as Jesus served. In fact, we are never more like Jesus than we are committed to serving as he served. Service challenges us to leave our place of comfort, to forsake what we often call normal, and to embrace a life that compels us to do something different. It embraces Paul's words from earlier in Philippians 2, verses 3 and 4, that says, "Do nothing out of selfish ambition and vain conceit, but in humility consider others better than yourself. Each of you should look not only to your own interest, but also to the interest of others." Humble service demonstrates the life-transforming power of Jesus to a broken, bruised, and aching world. It exhibits a countercultural calling that each one of us has been given, and it invites others into the kingdom that Jesus came to institute on that day so many years ago when he laid down his life. And in that act of ultimate service, of lowering himself to the lowest point, he revealed the power of God that we never imagined possible. When we choose to embrace this life of service, we are given a glimpse at the way that we are called to live, the way that God created us to live. Do you want a new normal? Do you want a reset on your life? Begin by focusing not on how you can be better, but how you can serve others and make their lives better. We have to make ourselves available to serve, because what we find is the more that we serve, we actually find ourselves in service. We find ourselves transformed. We find ourselves lifted up. When we make ourselves available to serve, it has consequences. And it may cause us to sacrifice, but what we will find is when we commit ourselves to serving as Jesus served, we will find the world challenged. We will find people seeing that commitment to serve and questioning their own drive and desire to elevate themselves because they see Jesus manifest in us. So my challenge as we close out this series is to commit yourself to service. Most of the challenges in this series have had time frames. It's been showing love to somebody this week. It's been committing to prioritize Christian community for 90 days. But this has no time frame because service, a life of service, can't. Service can't be a phase. It can't be a facade. It has to be a lifestyle. It's not something that you can put on and take off when in fashion. It has to be our way of life. Service, in a way, is the culmination of everything that has come before in this series. I appreciate Henri Nouwen in his book, Spiritual Direction. He kind of weaves together how so many of these play a part in service. He says, when I stand in the presence of the Lord with empty hands as a useless servant, I become aware of my dependence and my deep need for grace. Prayer helps me break down my pretense of wholeness and self-fulfillment and invites me to bend my knee, to close my eyes and stretch out my arms. In prayer, I hear God's voice calling me to move forward. I find my way home. I discover my vocation to care and be cared for in community. And that is what Jesus offers for us today. He is inviting us to find our way home through dependence on him, through prayer, through community, and through service. And he asks us to come home today.